And so on.
It's juiced. How's this? Is that better?
Yeah.
Michael, you talk.
Hello, Peter and William. I'm Peter. Why?
What's that thing that Michael, you yell? The cat's out of the bag! I had to turn that down so low because you fucking screamed it. The cat's out of the bag!
Okay, we just did an interview with Clint Burnham.
Lovely guy.
Next week. Yeah, very nice guy. Talked about viral psychoanalysis. Enjoy. I guess you've already listened to it by now, probably.
Yeah. You better listen to this because I just cycled through the hell woods.
I don't like it how you said that you went to a gathering.
Me?
Mm. Yeah, that stuck out to me too. A gathering?
When was I saying that?
Because I think it's when people don't want to say that what they were doing was a party.
What was I talking about?
Getting drunk.
When you're explaining how terrifying AI is, you're at a gathering.
Oh, it was fucking three people. That's not a party. What do you call the amount of people that's not yet a party?
I definitely can party by myself.
I think it needs to be like five people to be a party. Five or more.
No, I think people say gathering because they don't want people to... It's like if you invite somebody over when you're like drinking or whatever... You have to say it's not a party; it's just a gathering to like lower their expectations. I think it's a cop out.
I think if it's a matter of degree, but because like how sad is the party if there's two people? Yeah,
I don't know. We were at a really good time.
We were at my friend's house. His apartment on the lease said that he couldn't have parties, and there was a group of us, like five of us maybe, and then the landlady actually came by and was kind of yelling at us that we weren't allowed to have parties. Parties, and we were like, well, you know, what's a party? Like, is a wake a party? Like, what if we were mourning someone? Would that be a party?
Well, there's five of you, and by Pete's definition, that's party. The bare minimum.
No, that's actually pretty low. Let's say, was it five and you? It's like I have five party goers. Me. Wait, what's that joke? Like, I have two brothers, Will and me. Whatever. You know, you get what I mean.
Yeah.
You see where I'm going with that.
It's like there's a party in my mouth and everyone's invited.
Ooh, don't say that.
That's
what woods.
That's what all the guys in the woods say.
You're invited. And you're invited.
They're all taking their chance to see if they're invited.
I'm sat on a cut down tree. I'm a little worried about ticks, I'll be honest.
Are there ticks there?
Yeah, they're ticks. I don't think there's much Lyme disease, but...
If you do get Lyme disease, it's a good excuse for being lazy.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, Google tells me that they can be mostly found in forested areas in every region of France.
There you go.
Just do a full body exam when you get home.
Definitely.
Funny.
Hey babe, want to give me a full body tick exam?
don't say that in the woods.
Excuse me, sir.
This man's dream has come true.
Oh my god.
What's new with you guys? What's new with you, Mike?
I saw what's it called? What's Bo afraid of?
Oh yeah.
Bo is afraid.
Bo's afraid.
Mm. So maybe the alternate title in Australia is What's Bo Afraid Of?
Yeah. That's pretty good for 90 minutes. And then for another two and a bit hours, it's a slog. Mm-hmm. It's too wanky.
What? Yeah, it's fucking 3+ hour movie thing.
It's bullshit.
Gotta go.
Also, I think A24 is a little big for their britches at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Michael, there's another movie to add to the list of movies we're going to talk about someday with the repetition movies. Deja Vu.
Oh, yeah, you were saying, yeah.
That one's ripe. That's a great fucking movie. You know what? I've gone through a Denzel conversion. I've seen 5 Denzel movies in the last 4 days.
Wow.
I like Denzel, hey.
He's got a real cool, sassy way of talking.
He does, yeah.
Mm.
For the past couple days, I've been trying to convince people that something is going on with AI right now, like very, very quickly. And it's worrying. And people are like, whatever, it's fine. I'm like, no, you gotta, like, this is the death of music. It's the death of music. Why would anyone want anything new when they can just be like, hey, you know what'd be cool if this new song was sung by my favorite singer of all time? And they're never going to
want
to hear
anything
else.
People do want something new.
Well, I don't know. I think a lot of people, the way they listen to music is they want a variation of what they already like.
Definitely scared me a lot when I woke up this morning and read your guys' texts.
I was drunk when we were messaging each other last night, so I don't really remember. I remember saying Michael saying, this is the future and it sucks.
I want this to turn into like a Blair Witch Project thing where Will's running through the woods.
But like still talking about Zizek.
I think I heard something. Anyway, so the sublime object of ideology.
You guys have to tell me if there's someone sneaking up behind me.
Okay. Some guy trying to listen to our patron content for free.
Okay, so hello.
Hello, nature correspondent Will.
Yeah, so I'm actually in the middle of the forest right now. And believe it or not, it's better cell reception here than in my apartment. I got a hummingbird right here. So yeah, I rode like half an hour into the woods in this park called Bois de Vincennes, which used to be the private grounds of the kings. There's like a big castle down there. I think Charles the Fourth was born there. So I'm in the king's hunting grounds, I think.
A lot of kings live there, I heard.
Mm-hmm. Lots of kings. I rode the, you know, I had to find a place that had at least 3 bars. So that took a while. I had to avoid all the kind of single men kind of appearing out of the foliage. There are prostitutes along the outer edges, and then there are people. There are also what I do what we're there are lots of tent encampments here. So I had to find a place. No tents. I ended up in this like kind of. I'm like near a zoo area kind of, and I was going to post up near there, but there were lots of children and I thought someone might have be suspicious of me
because you look like
it actually sounds pretty scary, you know, like surrounded by like creepy men prostitutes.
I'm a little sketched, out.
And wild animals,
but it's also
up.
Beautiful. It's a gorgeous day though. It's gorgeous. All the leaves are out.
It's a gorgeous day to get raped, murdered, and eaten by a lion whilst children laugh at you.
My friend sent me a screenshot. He was asking ChatGPT about some kind of official government thing. And he said that this is just how it should work. The bureaucracy should just be an AI. And then I remembered the thing that Zizek says about bureaucracy is that it actually functions by exception. So we all know, maybe you guys know this instance where you go and you're talking to someone, some representative of the state, and you have all your forms, and there's something, you run up against a barrier, and they decide that just this once they're going to make an exception for you. And Zizek says, this is actually how bureaucracy works.
Yeah. Perfect.
And I don't think an AI could make an exception.
No, never. Yeah. Wait, I think your mic is a little like overloading the closest okay. to your mouth.
Excuse me, sir. What do you think about Slavoj Zizek?
Man on the street. Yeah.
At least you're doing it in a foreign country, so no one can hear what you're actually saying.
That's true.
Imagine going home to your wife after going for a walk through the woods with your son, and you're like, yeah, there was this creep in the bushes. Talking into a microphone about Slavoj Zizek.
I definitely feel like a pervert.
All right.
Today
on Zizek and so on.
Today we're talking about, finally, Looking Awry. Have we ever talked about this book before?
Probably.
I thought we had, but I realized that I confused it like the aesthetic of it with the Lacan and Hitchcock one. It just, I don't know, in my mind, they look the same.
They don't.
Yeah, they don't. Okay.
Maybe it's
this
like
is actually
the
one
of
his coolest
book.
book covers.
And book style, like the type of material.
Mm-hmm. It's a very kind of like early internet feel to it, with like the pixelated cover.
I lost my copy.
But I guess this came out, this is his third book?
It came out the same year as For They Don't Know What They Do. They were both out in 1991.
But it's slightly after.
Yeah.
Another crucial point I've made just there.
These two things look kind of similar, and one happened at a different time than the other thing. Okay, Looking Awry, an introduction to Jacques Lacan through popular culture, released 1991 by Slavoj Žižek. It's his third book.
Really good.
It's fucking insanely good, man. It's so good.
It like hits the perfect mix of highly theoretical and very readable at the same time.
Mm. Yeah, they're really tight essays, 10 to 20 page essays. And we read the first one.
How real is reality?
And yeah, it says he's introducing this notion of looking awry, which pops up a lot in his work. And we've mentioned it before, but we've never given it the old look askance.
Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, maybe his first iteration of something like the parallax view.
Yeah, because he talks a lot about perspectival shifts in Sublime Object and For They Know.
Mm-hmm.
Then he drops that, and then there's Looking Awry, and then he eventually drops Looking Awry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he does. He gets the phrase from Richard II, the Shakespeare play that we have all read.
Yep.
I had to take a class for my English degree on Renaissance drama, not including Shakespeare. And it really made me appreciate how good Shakespeare is, because mostly they were not good.
Mm-hmm. Christopher Marlowe.
Yep. Ben Jonson, that other guy. There were some good plays, but mostly they were just like, what do I do with my daughter? Can you please marry her? I don't want to marry her. She's ugly. Okay, then how about you marry my other daughter? I mean, it finds its only audience with English degree losers who are like, actually, Ben Jonson is better than Shakespeare. No, he's not.
Well, one thing that came to mind while I was reading this was how like classics people and then like early modern people, as opposed to people who are interested in like more contemporary theory, each think that the truth of what everyone else is searching for is within their field of study.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, to some extent, I'm doing the same thing with more contemporary readings of these things. However, the more contemporary one is aware of its place in this in a way that the narrow like, focus on like classics or early modern studies are not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And maybe aware of the subject position of the reader.
Yeah, and Žižek says something great. He says that this play proves that Shakespeare read Lacan.
That's right, yeah.
I love that, yeah.
All right, let's jump into it. No?
Yeah, before he gets to Richard III, he talks about Zeno's paradoxes. He begins with actually a pretty like succinct definition of the concept of looking awry. He says, mm-hmm. What is at stake in the endeavor to look awry at theoretical motifs is not just a kind of contrived attempt to illustrate high theory, to make it easily accessible, and thus disparage the effort of effective thinking. The point is rather that such an exemplification, such mise en scène of theoretical motifs, renders visible the aspects that would otherwise remain unnoticed.
Yeah, so Looking Awry seeks to make visible the examples of theory, but not just finding an example to illustrate it as best we can, or reducing the theory to the example.
Mm-hmm. Something is borne out in the theory through the example.
Yeah, like I was once trying to explain to someone when I was first encountering Žižek the concept of retroactivity, and he said, oh, like history is written by the victors, which like totally killed the idea.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So like Žižek is making the case that there's like some kind of procedure of exemplification, like the looking awry that accords with the theory itself, that is the theory.
Mm-hmm.
The finding of the example is part of the theorizing itself.
Yeah, and he points out that this is what Hegel and Wittgenstein do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He says this is the basic strategy of Hegel's phenomenology of spirit, is to undermine a given theoretical position by staging it as an existential subjective attitude.
Yeah.
That of asceticism, beautiful soul, the unhappy consciousness, these things, and thus reveal its otherwise hidden inconsistencies. That is, to exhibit the way its very subjective position of enunciation undermine its own enunciated, its positive contents.
Yeah. And that's like,
so yeah, it's
developed in For They Know Not What They Do.
Mm-hmm.
How so?
That's where he first develops it. So it's like about the, something he calls it like the existential dramatization of a theoretical position. With Looking Awry, the idea is it's like, it's paradoxical because rather than seeing an object in the common sense or immediate way or doxa understanding of something, like Will was saying, the inconsistencies and contradictions are revealed. So it's aspects mm-hmm. of the object are rendered visible that an ordinary or immediate perspective represses.
Yeah.
Like
it's like he doesn't use this language for it, but he does. You know, it's the same thing of the form falling into its content as a member of its content.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, the way, like in phenomenology, the way he's explaining spirit is to work through the various subjective experiences and to show their inconsistencies
mm-hmm.
and how they kind of lead to the next.
Which, you know, this is also a theory, obviously, of Zizek's own use of examples and method of exemplification.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, totally.
And that's what he's doing in this book. Like, it's supposed to be a guide to Lacan through popular culture, right? So it's a staging of the theory.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. The staging comes on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the whole point with Zeno's paradoxes is that he's presenting a common sense understanding of motion and time.
Mm-hmm.
And the point is that he stages that in order to show its inconsistencies and contradictions.
Yeah, but then kind of manages to say the opposite of what he means to say, which is, as Zizek points out, is a much more interesting thing to say.
Mm-hmm, so let's he says, like, to demonstrate the fecundity of such an approach, let's turn to the first proper philosopher, Parmenides, who asserted the sole existence of being as one. Being is for Parmenides.
Mm-hmm.
And then Zeno, a disciple of Parmenides, issues these paradoxes to prove that the multitude, the being is becoming perspective is flawed because it runs into these paradoxes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I kind of assume that they all kind of meant the same thing, but I like how he twists them in three separate ways to say.
And also he shows that Zeno is doing something that he's describing as Hegel is doing, as Lacan himself are doing, where Zeno's pulling from literary examples
mm-hmm.
and twisting it to his theory, to his paradoxes.
Yeah, that's a point that Zizek is citing here, called the literary technique of Zeno's paradoxes. He says that Milner presents the main paradoxes as basically examples of literary tropes, as we were just saying. He draws on the Iliad, and then he kind of mixes it with a popular example. So the first one is the scenario where Achilles is chasing Hector in the Iliad, and he can't catch him. He can't catch up to him. And the popular iteration of this is the Aesop's fable that we all read when we were kids, of the hare and the tortoise. Yeah, it's a canon. It's a kid canon.
Yeah.
So he says that what we have here is thus the relation of the subject to the object, experienced by every one of us in a dream. The subject, faster than the object, gets closer and closer to it, and yet can never attain it. The dream paradox of a continuous approach to an object that nevertheless preserves a constant distance.
So he's like tying in a psychoanalytical dimension to these paradoxes.
It's like, you know, when you're in a dream, when you're trying to run and you can't move. Mm-hmm. Never happened to you? Yeah.
A common one for me is trying to fly, but I've forgotten how, so I can only get like a few feet off the ground.
There's another nice version of this in Brecht's Three Penny Opera. Do not run after luck too arduously, because it might happen that you will overrun it, and luck will thus stay behind. Yeah, so he's making this point about libidinal economy. The paradox stages the relation of the subject to the object cause of its desire, which can never be attained.
Yeah, the object cause is always missed. So all you can do is encircle it, is what he says. So he says the topology of this paradox of Zeno is the paradoxical topology of the object of desire that eludes our grasp no matter what we do to attain it. As opposed to the Sisyphus one, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then the second one is the arrow and the target. So you fire an arrow at a target, and Zeno's point is the arrow should never hit the target because the distance is traversed by the arrow in half, and then another half, and then another half, and then another half ad infinitum, and it shouldn't ever hit the target.
Oh, I remember another one is we never got out of bed. It's a similar logic of that.
What is that?
It's like in order to get out of bed, you have to like get up, but getting up involves the same, like if you divide it by half and half and half.
Mm-hmm. And the example of this in the Odyssey is Heracles. Heracles is continually shooting an arrow from his bow. He completes the act again and again, but in spite of this incessant activity on his part, the arrow remains motionless. We're condemned to repeat the same act indefinitely. With the psychoanalytic angle brought in there, Zizek says that this expresses the Lacanian distinction between need and desire.
Yeah, need, demand, and desire.
Mm-hmm. In desire, the object that might readily fulfill a need becomes something else. It's transubstantiated from use to exchange value and enters into the libidinal economy and becomes, as Zizek says, not the satisfaction of a need attached to it, but confirmation of the other's attitude towards us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Lacan's formula is desire is what remains after need gets subtracted from demand.
Mm, okay.
So the idea would be something like a child's hungry, which is a need or a demand, and the parent gives them food. But what's important is that in the intersubjective relation where the parent shows the child that it's loved, because at the bottom for Lacan, it's a demand for love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it becomes something else.
It's a surplus of more than a biological significance.
Mm-hmm. And Tantalus pays for his greed by his striving. He pays for his greed with the striving after the exchange value. Whenever he obtains an object, loses its use value, and becomes gold. So when he's trying to eat it, it changes into gold.
Yeah.
And yeah. King Midas too, right? I think is a similar
figure. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like when the sublime becomes shit.
Mm. Yeah, vice versa. It's the same thing in the end, I guess.
Gold member.
Yeah.
You see, Mr. Power, I love gold. The look of it, the taste of it, the smell of it, the texture.
I like gold, Mr. Powers.
Yeah, so like this is all to do with this, at least leads to a surplus enjoyment, right? Like the real purpose of the drive isn't the goal, but the aim. Mm.
Yeah,
to reproduce itself as drive.
Exampled most succinctly for Zizek in Sisyphus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In his continuous pushing of the stone up the hill, and then it rolls down as a literary model for Zeno's third paradox.
A goal once reached always retreats anew.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's nice.
So as soon as he... Did I write that or did Zizek write that?
Don't know. Let's say you did.
Zizek. It's Zizek. I highlighted that sentence. I was like, oh, damn, that's a good sentence.
I can't tell what I wrote here and what Zizek wrote. But they're both brilliant. This is the notion of drive, right? Mm-hmm. This is the logic of the drive.
Yeah.
Its ultimate aim is to reproduce itself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
a circular path. Yeah.
Camus, he doesn't say that specifically, but he says that we should imagine Sisyphus happy. Basically what he's... But he says that it's not about reaching the end. It's about the sustained, continuous effort to push the stone up for the drive to perpetuate itself. I don't know if Lacan would say that makes you happy, but...
It'd be a kind of traversing the fantasy, right? Like where you realize that the pleasure or the enjoyment is gained from the act of pushing it up the hill, not getting to the top of the hill.
It's like the edging of Sisyphus.
So the general conclusion. So like where Zeno tried to use these paradoxes as to disprove other forms of philosophy beyond Parmenides, this perspective, the psychoanalytic perspective, shows the way in which they're like valid, the way that mm-hmm. they are actual descriptions of how we experience the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because as soon as you grasp the thing itself, it retreats. It's unrealizable. But that it's such a cool point he's making there about this, these examples of Zeno's paradoxes, each with something to say about the nature of desire, are themselves an expression of the impossible real of desire. Since what he sets out to do, which is assert the primacy of the immovable one, is contradicted by what he effectively says.
Mm-hmm.
And Zizek's drawing out that distinction, what is effectively said and what's meant and what's effectively said. Yeah, like it ends up delimiting the ways in which the logic breaks down and contradicts itself and gets caught up in a different logic, the logic of fantasy.
So we more Heraclitians or Parmenideans?
I'm a Heraclitus guy.
Yeah.
And Hegel is also a Heraclitus guy, so.
Yeah.
I'll refer to the big H.
Big H on the big H. I remember when I was at the farm last year, there was a river below me, and I remember jokingly telling you guys I would sit on the balcony and contemplate Heraclitus.
I had a twist on Heraclitus. We'll cut this out too, but when Heraclitus walked into the river, he wondered if he was the same man that had walked into it the other time.
Yeah.
That's Socrates too. Someone said to Socrates, it's incredible. He traveled the world. He spent years of his life on this great adventure, and when he came back, he was exactly as he had been. And Socrates said, "Well, of course, he took himself along with him."
Oh, dude, it's so tragic.
That's a fucking great line.
Yeah, that's from Montaigne. That's one of his baller quotes. Montaigne.
Not to be too classics guy, because I was just making fun of it, but the Greeks, man, the ancient Greeks, so fucking
killer,
spot on about so much. It's crazy.
Yeah. So again, here Zizek says what Zeno wants to say, his intention is to exclude the paradoxical nature of our relationship to objet A by proving its non-existence. But what he effectively does, or more properly says, is to articulate the very paradoxes that define the status of this object as impossible real.
Mm-hmm.
To some extent, he wasn't locating himself within the paradox.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he says that what Zeno excludes is the very dimension of fantasy.
Yeah.
And so in a sense, fantasy stages our desire, right? Like,
yeah.
It's through fantasy that we're constituted as desiring subjects, and it's in that frame of fantasy that provides or stages our relationship with the object of desire. Like, it mm-hmm. provides a form for us to desire, because without the fantasy, without the structural coordinates of the fantasy, there's no relationship to the object cause of desire or the object itself, right?
It teaches you, like, what to desire, right?
Mm-hmm. And how, because without it, you don't know how. There's no imagined version of it.
We think of the staging of desire as a scene in which the desire will be fulfilled, but that's actually what desire is.
Mm-hmm.
That staging itself, the sense that, Zizek says, on the contrary, fantasy is usually conceived as a scenario that realizes the subject's desire. This elementary definition is quite adequate on the condition that we take it literally. What the fantasy stages is not a scene in which our desires are filled, fully satisfied, but on the contrary, a scene that realizes stages the desire as such.
Yeah, say so.
So that fantasy scenario is fantasy. It's not the fantasy of getting the thing that fantasy fantasizes mm-hmm. about.
Right. That's a good
nice.
Point.
Nice.
See, like, for instance, someone might have a fantasy where, you know, they enter the woods and they encounter a podcaster alone. I just found this footnote, and I don't know why I included it as a footnote, because it's basically, you know, the perfect succinct framing of his point while also bringing Hegel into it. He says, in other words, we could pin down the ultimate paradox of Zeno's paradoxes by means of the Hegelian distinction between what the subject intends to say and what he effectively says. Mm. The distinction that incidentally coincides with the Lacanian distinction between signification and significance.
Nice.
Yep. Yep.
Because this Zeno chapter appears in Sublime, the most sublime hysterics.
Oh, does it?
Mm.
There is a passage here, Michael, that Zizek is describing that someone leaves their conditions and goes to a different, you know, country or whatever. And in spite of the fact, Zizek says that his new life so closely resembles the old, he is firmly convinced that this is the beginning again was not in vain, i.e. that it was well worth the trouble to cut ties and begin a new life. Here we see the function of the objet petit a at its purest. From the point of view, I love this distinction, but from the point of view of wisdom, the break is not worth it. The trouble ultimately we always find is not worth the trouble. Ultimately, we always find ourselves in the same position from which we have tried to escape, which is why instead of running after the impossible, we must learn to consent to our common lot and find pleasure in the trivia of everyday life. But then he says, but where do we find the petit objet a? The objet a is precisely that surplus, that elusive make-believe that drove the man to change his existence. In reality, it is nothing at all, just an empty surface. His life after the break is the same as before, but because of it, the break is nonetheless well worth the trouble.
Interesting.
There's a great book called The Late Mattia Pascal by Luigi Pirandello. It's about a guy who he's very encumbered in his life. He's kind of been obliged because of his father's debts to marry the daughter of his father's debtor. And so he's living this horrible life where he doesn't really like his wife, and her mother lives with him too, and she's a complete burden. And one day he's given some money to take to another town. And when he gets to this other town, the person is not there to give the money to. And he kind of messes around for a few days and goes home. And in the meantime, someone has committed suicide in his hometown, and everyone assumes it's him.
Hmm.
And so he realizes that he has a chance. Everyone thinks he's dead, and he has a bunch of money, so he leaves. He flees the city, and he goes to a part of Italy he's never been to, and he starts a whole new life. But then slowly, his life starts to gather the weight that his former life did. He tries to live in a very abstracted way and not get to know anyone, but inevitably he gets to know these people and starts a relationship. And then it kind of becomes as much of a burden as his former life. So he goes back to his former life. But the whole scenario, you know, like Zizek says here, he's been changed.
I read the short story that he refers to in this one, The Store of the Worlds or whatever.
Yeah, how's that?
It was really good. It was interesting in this context. Only like 5 pages. Basically, a guy goes to a shop that he's been told by a friend that if you go there, you can experience your deepest desire. And in order to do so, you have to bring all your wealth, all like your most treasured objects. And this old guy has some way of doing it. But the cost is that it removes 10 years of your life. And after a while, talking about it with the old man who's going to do it, he decides, no, he's going to think about it. And he goes home and he needs to help his child with his homework, and his wife is having troubles and he soothes those. Then he goes to work and there's problems in the stock market, all the trials and tribulations of banal life. And then at some point he wakes up in the store. The old man is like, what was it like? And the protagonist, he refuses to tell him. And the old man's like, nobody ever does. And when he leaves the store, he walks out into a nuclear wasteland because there's been some sort of fallout from the atom bomb or whatever.
Yeah, but that's the point though, right? Like you desire itself.
Yeah, in this case, it's... he lives a life that he was already living in order to stave off getting outside of this circuit of the drive.
The Sisyphean dimension of his life.
Mm.
All right, so we move on to where he talks about looking awry.
Yeah, I'm just going to go to the bathroom. I'll be right back.
Oh, yeah. How's Will going to go to the bathroom out in these bushes with all these kids around?
All the world's a urinal. All right, let's move on to Richard II and the Shakespeare play from which Zizek steals the term looking awry. So everyone knows. Well, Zizek says here, the fascinating contours of the object of desire, where a normal view sees nothing but a trivial everyday object, is literally a gaze capable of seeing nothingness, i.e. of seeing an object begot by nothing. As Shakespeare formulated in his short scene in Richard II, one of his most interesting plays, Richard II proves beyond any doubt that Shakespeare had read Lacan. For the basic problem of the drama is that of the hystericization of a king.
A process whereby the king loses the second sublime body that makes him king. Speaking of which, coronation coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was going to say, we've already talked about this, but I just don't care that much about the king. I don't care enough to like feel passionately about not wanting one, because that strikes me as, you know, being.
You know
obsessed.
What we should do next time? We should do an episode on the shit that Zizek constantly says about the monarch and Hegel too.
It would be fitting. That'd be fun.
Not as a you know, support of King whatever his name is.
Charles.
I don't know. I'm with Pete on this. Like, Pete was talking about it one time where it was like, it's good that it's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Like, there's something about how, like, fucking dumb it is. Like, this dude with, like, all these medals on his shirt. And it's funny.
It's because, the arbitrariness of his natural birth. Like, it seems like the everyday notion is that the monarch is the person with the blood, right? But Hegel's idea is that this is actually the most stupidly contingent thing possible, so just on by merit of someone's birth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to do with any of their positive attributes at all.
In terms of like the arbitrariness of the king, I was talking about this the other day regarding last names, because there's something arbitrary about them, and that's what's great about it, is that it kind of connects you with the like societal past context that you're in, but not for any real reason.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think we should just insert the dialogue from that YouTube video of this back and forth between Bushy and the Queen.
Yeah, but it'd be kind of funny if we read it.
Yeah, that would be funny.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Each substance of a grief hath 20 shadows, which show like grief itself, but are not so. For sorrow's eye, glazed with blinding tears, divides one thing entire to many objects. Like perspectives, which rightly gazed upon, show nothing but confusion, eyed awry. Distinguished form, so sweet majesty, looking awry upon your lord's departure. 50 shades of grief more than himself to wail, which, looked as it is not but shadows of what is not. Then, thrice gracious queen, more than your lord's departure, weep not, more's not seen. Or if it be, 'tis with false sorrow's eye, which for things true weeps things imaginary.
It may be so, but with my inward soul persuades me it is otherwise. However it be, I cannot but be sad, so heavy sad, as though in thinking or no thought I think, makes me with heavy nothing faint and shrink.
'Tis nothing but conceit, my gracious queen.
'Tis nothing less. Conceit is still derived from some forefather grief. Mine is not so, for nothing hath begot my something grief. Oh, something hath the nothing that I grieve. 'Tis in reversion that I do possess. But what it is that is not yet known, what I cannot name, 'tis nameless woe I wot.
Hey, Pete. Nice. You said 50 shades of grief.
What is the actual line?
Finds shapes of grief.
I haven't been reading 50 Shades of Grey. Okay, I live near a secondhand shop where there's the book 50 Shades of Grey everywhere.
It's so a very interesting slip, Peter.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, there's some deep theoretical themes in that book.
So, okay, Zizek wants to stress here that there's a contradiction in Bushy's speech, in Peter's speech, where on one hand there's the gaze of sorrow, which divides one thing entire to many objects, the thing itself and the shadows it produces in the multiple interpretations and subjective impressions it creates, a metaphor for the ambiguous and degraded impressions of the thing itself, and the anamorphic metaphor, how the flaw of the gaze is the flaw in the object itself, the logic of which is quite different, Zizek says, a detail in the picture that, gazed rightly, i.e. straightforwardly, appears as a blurred spot, assumes clear, distinguished shapes once we look at it awry at an angle. But yeah, he's again pointing here that there's a separation between what is said and what is intended. He writes that this creates two realities. On the level of the first metaphor, we have common sense reality as seen as substance with 20 shadows, as a thing split into 20 reflections by our subjective view. In short, as a substantial reality distorted by our subjective perceptive. And this is the level of reality understood by the notion of, this is me here. This is the notion of reality as understood by the notion of like subjective personal bias. Mm-hmm. What we see is what we want to see. The stolen idea there that there is a more true thing being distorted by this process.
Yeah.
And so there is still possible, like a matter of fact way of seeing it where we could see it as it really is.
Which is why the Bushy character is saying, Queen, you know, the way you're looking at it is skewed by your grief.
Yeah.
There is a real, more total way of perceiving the situation that you're being kept from understanding. Whereas,
yeah, he says like there's the paradox here is like that what we see by looking awry are the things that are in a sense more clear to us because we gaze with an interested view. Right. And the distortion is itself the true feature of the object.
Because in this scene, the queen's skewed perspective of the situation of the king is actually a true understanding of what's going on in the context of the plot.
Yeah, I thought it was cool here, like that phrase, like what we want to see can be redoubled here in the sense that like what we want to see in the sense of wanting to see that interested aspect of it, but also in the desiring sense, like what we desire to see.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's cool.
So yeah, his point is that the desiring gaze distorts the object, but also creates in it what there is to be desired, which objectively is not there.
Yeah. And it's also like that episode we did on the violence of beginnings, right? Like where the supposed origin that's lost is constituted retroactively. So if you have immediate direct experience of the object, supposedly, and then you have a distorted perspective, which is the looking awry, in the looking awry, you produce retroactively the idea that there is some impartial view. That's not distorted by desire.
Mm. It just reminds me of this part in The Man Without Qualities. The narrator is talking about the distinction between Austro-Hungarian mentality and Hungarian and what constitutes both of them. The Hungarians in the Austro-Hungarian Empire consider themselves Hungarians and not Austrian, whereas the Austrians consider themselves Austro-Hungarian because it meant the Austrian Empire. But of course, they're not actually Hungarian in any way. So it creates this like weird surplus Hungarian-ness to the Austrian, which doesn't actually mean anything. It doesn't refer to Hungarians or Hungary.
Mm-hmm.
Also in this dynamic of desire being added to the look, the classic Lacanian example of the painting of the ambassadors, death can only be, observed if looked at askance, if looked at askewed and awry. Mm.
Yep. And then he ties it in very nicely with the logic of Capital. He says that it was no accident that Shakespeare was so attentive to these paradoxes of something begot by nothing, for he lived in a period of the rapid dissolution of pre-capitalist social relations and of the lively emergence of the elements of capitalism. Peter, this is what you were saying about like a historicist reading of Shakespeare or like a medievalist reading of Shakespeare as being like understanding the context in which Shakespeare wrote versus reading Shakespeare for today, through today.
Hasn't Zizek said something about Shakespeare being more true today than he was in his time?
Yeah. Hence, he says Shakespeare's sensitivity to the paradoxical power of money, which converts everything into its opposite.
And this is, of course, the Lacanian link between surplus value and surplus enjoyment.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Or one thing about, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here, but there's something interesting about observation of a painting. It reminded me of like if you look at an impressionist painting, objectively, it doesn't depict the thing very clearly, right?
Yeah.
But when you look at it as if through the subjective position of someone viewing the scene, of the painter for instance, or how these objective characteristics like feel and impact you, then the true meaning of the painting becomes apparent.
Yeah. It's also like when you're too close to a painting and all of the brush strokes or whatever, it's just this mess. And there's a certain distance from the painting that you can stand for it to cohere. Because, of course, with the ambassador's one, it's that you have to stand at a funny angle for the skull to emerge.
And this is what he, this is what was missing for Zizek in Zeno's understanding of his own paradox.
That didn't take into account fantasy.
He did have a very interesting minor point here about the kind of like the fantasy of past time, either like in your own history or in history. He says that like this nostalgic yearning for that natural being in which in which things were only what they were, in which we perceived them straightforwardly, in which our gaze had not yet been distorted by the anamorphic spot.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at before about that return to a loss, like the imagined beginning prior to the violence of loss.
Yeah, because you never see the what was lacking or inconsistent in that time. You see only the fantasy of a kind of fully realized plenitude of like experience, and in which your like yearning is expressed in like a wholeness of experience. Do you yearn? Do you ever yearn? I yearn. I sit and I yearn. he did kind of like ontologize this idea of looking awry in a brilliant way. He said that the frontier separating the two substances, I think there is, it's still the like what is intended and what is meant. The objective view from the substance of enjoyment that, can be perceived clearly only by looking awry is precisely what prevents us from sliding into psychosis, such as the effect of the symbolic order on the gaze. And this is the brilliant part, I think, that the emergence of language opens up a hole in reality, and this hole shifts the access to our gaze. Language redoubles reality into itself, and the void of the thing can be filled only out of an anamorphic gaze from aside. And in this sense, it redoubles reality into itself and opens this void of which language is the expression. You know, the thing that speaks to which is not there retroactively creates the void from which it springs.
It is eludes it.
I think that's brilliant. Language is anamorphous.
That's
a cool point.
Because immediately it produces this idea that there is a real outside of language.
That, which everyone thinks, the, like, you know, oh, animals live in this plenitude of experience and they don't need language, right? But, like, you can think of it as humans. Humans have this, you know, weird way of looking awry.
This distortion, which is the field of desire.
Yeah, so, like, the reality that we live in is a totally different reality. Not reducible to the objective features of it, but only distinguishable by the distortion of it through language.
And so, can AI look awry?
Fuck no.
No.
Well, I think we can leave it there, right?
Yeah, definitely, dude.
Yeah. Nice talking to you guys.
Yep.
Talk again soon.
Bye-bye.
Cool.
Bye-bye.
And so on.